Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Thursday, December 11th. We have Peter Buchvar, Ira Harris, and Judd Hirschberg. Peter is Chief Investment Officer at the One Point BFG Wealth Partners firm. He also has a great Substack platform that offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Ira is independent trader, past hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently in 2019. We also have today Chief Investment Strategist Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading Strategies to help form the basis of some of the discussion with his technical charts and indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Richard.
Great. Peter, I thought we'd begin with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Do we have 5 hours?
Yeah.
The economy. All right, let's slice up the U.S. economy. We know the areas of strength, upper income spending, travel, leisure, restaurants, and so forth. We know that data center build out is contributing actually most of the GDP growth as seen in the first half of the year. And the ripple effect that a data center build has, you're talking about the biggest one I've seen is a 4 million square foot facility, the one that Meta is building in Louisiana, but I think that's now becoming commonplace. So look at all the jobs that are created by just by building the facility. Whether it's the cement layer to the steel and the aluminum to the HVAC to the electrical equipment and the wiring and so on, let alone obviously all the chips and the servers and everything else. So the spend is obviously enormous, and we can see that in what the hyperscalers are announcing. Oracle in particular, since that's the latest number, they raised their fiscal 2026 CapEx number to $55 billion. And just for perspective, their expected revenue in fiscal 26 is about $65 billion. So they're spending almost all of their revenue, not on cash flow. Cash flow, it's eaten up probably all of their cash flow, but just almost eating up all of their revenue on CapEx. And then, of course, anybody deriving benefits from the U.S. government with the budget deficit relative to GDP still north of 6%. Healthcare, obviously a big beneficiary of that spend, the defense sector, interest earners, even though the Fed just clipped us, those savers that have had money in treasuries by another 25 basis points. So interest income, and one of the downsides of Federal Reserve rate cuts is that it's negatively impacting interest income, which is what higher income spenders were generating a bunch of income from, particularly boomers who were using their interest income to go on cruises and so forth. On the flip side, manufacturing's been in a recession now for about 3 years, prolonged by the tariff war, which raised costs on everybody who makes anything anywhere in the world and sources products around the world. Housing has been in a recession, obviously, for the last couple of years. Lower to middle income consumers have struggled with the higher cost of living. Global trade is somewhat mixed. A lot of quirky distortions related around tariffs this year, but I think overall, it's somewhat mixed. And then the labor market, we've seen the pace of firings as seen by jobless claims relatively muted, but then you have the Challenger numbers showing a notable increase in firings. But let's just call that a truce in a way that we, relatively speaking, it's a modest pace of firings. But then the hiring rate has slowed dramatically, and we've seen that in a variety of numbers. And Tuesday will be an interesting day when we get both October and November payroll stats. Now, broadening that out, you look at China. China is still a mixed situation where you have slow growth related to the residential real estate market. Manufacturing's been in an overall recession there as well, but areas of a lot of strength in Chinese manufacturing, particularly producing EVs and solar panels and robotics and so forth, and where China is really climbing far up the value-added chain. They're with our help incentivize, they've created a huge technology industry, particularly in AI and also semiconductors. You look at the rest of Southeast Asia, somewhat mixed. Singapore doing well, Vietnam doing well, Indonesia a little soft spot, Thailand sort of mixed. China is doing okay. Europe, mixed bag there too. Germany and France that are just challenged with almost no growth, while you have Greece and Spain seeing the most robust growth in Europe, and even Italy is seeing some decent growth. So I think overall, there's not one big party going on. It depends on whose house you show up on at. That's either a raging party if it's tied to AI or upper income spend, or it's a big downer if you're in other parts of the economy.
That's a great whirlwind tour. You're a South Ira. Are you aligned?
That was a great whirlwind tour, and let me tell
Yeah.
you this. Let me tell you this, because he won't say it, but every morning he puts this out in it, and it's so succinct and concise that you should really invest at Weekly so you can have access to this. It's great. Exactly what Peter. So now we're there. So we run around and we've done it, and we haven't gotten to the meat and potatoes from yesterday with the Fed. So we have a lot of places to go. And then we had the Swiss today. So I hope we'll get to that. But that just took us around the globe in a very succinct, as usual, fashion. So let's just jump off from there. You don't need to hear anything more from me.
Okay, what do you think, Peter, of the Fed decisions and actions this week, like the announcement of $40 billion to buy of T-bills, and what the effects will that be on the markets?
Well, we'll start with the rate move. It was interesting because about 6 weeks ago, when the Fed had their September meeting, rate cut odds for December, they of course cut in September, but for the December meeting, going into the September meeting, the Fed funds futures were pricing in about an 80% chance that they would cut again in December. Jay Powell purposely pulled that back to about 50-50. He felt that, let's not get ahead of our skis here. There's still more data to be seen. Inflation's still stuck at around 3, and let's see. And then, of course, he parrots out John Williams a couple of weeks ago, and in cahoots, John Williams tells the markets, hey, never mind, because at that point, rate cut odds had fallen to 32% going into the December meeting. And John Williams said, huh, we changed our mind. We're going to cut. And then, of course, going into the meeting was basically 100% almost. I think the Fed, and I think just generally when people look at this, they tend to think that a labor market mandate and a price stability mandate are just two separate things. And if one is far from the target, or we can just focus on that irrespective of the other, if the other one is around the target. But I think when you look at what is the biggest pain point of the US economy, and this is just me talking, I'll get to the Fed in a second, in terms of how the Fed is looking at this and how I think others on the Fed, the dissenters are looking at it, is the biggest pain point is inflation. Not necessarily the rate of it, because it's slowed, but of course, if you're impacted by tariffs, you don't care if it's a one-time thing or not. You look at it as another cost pressure on top of all the other cost pressures you've had to deal with. But in terms of inflation negatively impacting households, particularly lower to middle income, which we said earlier, but also from a small, medium-sized business perspective that has less financial capabilities and flexibility as bigger companies, cost pressures really weigh on their margins. So I think the disease is inflation. The symptom is a slower pace of hirings. It is no coincidence that beginning in April, if you look at the ADP number, small business hiring started to slow. Because a lot of these small businesses, and you don't have to be a manufacturer to be impacted by tariffs, you can be a restaurant that is importing paper products for your restaurant, or forks and knives and tableware from China, or avocados from Mexico, or bananas, or whatever it is, or even coffee that you serve to customers. You don't need to be a maker of things to have been impacted by the tariffs. So labor market growth slowed dramatically beginning in April. So here we are, fast forward to the Fed, when the Fed's like, well, the labor market's softening, let's cut. Even though inflation is still around this 2.75, 3% level, depending on whether you look at CPI, PCE. Now, that said, if inflation decelerates further, if the unemployment rate rises further, okay, then the Fed has some leeway to further cut. But as part of that, we talk about the neutral rate, which is a made-up number. It's spit out by some econometric model, but let's just go with it. The Fed has told us all year in all their dot plots that they think the long-run real neutral rate, and it's important to look at the real rate because many people conflate the rate and they only look at the nominal rate. So they see 3% in the dot plot and they think that the Fed should just go to 3% today. No, 3% is the neutral rate if inflation's at 2. In other words, the neutral rate is a real rate of 1%. So what did the Fed do? With the 2.8% PCE number that we saw for September, they took the real rate below 1%. So when we look out to next year, well, the Fed is essentially at target. So with Jay's last three meetings, like I said, he's going to need to see a further deceleration in inflation and or a notable rise in the unemployment rate for him to cut again. So I think that that's how people should think about that. But, and I know we'll get to this, notwithstanding what the Fed has done with the short end, notwithstanding what the Bank of England has done with their overnight bank rate, which they'll cut again next week, and the ECB, long rates continue to go higher. And the BOJ on December 19th is going to raise interest rates, even though it's essentially fully priced in. I think your wait is going to leave the door open for more cut, hikes next year, which I don't think the market's fully prepared for. They're prepared for the hike in December, but I think that they're not so ready for more next year. So we've seen this drop in short rates, a rise in long rates, which is an unusual situation, particularly during the 40-year bond bull market, which tells me again, that we're not out of the woods here when it comes to longer-term bond duration. Interest rates are still remaining elevated, trending higher to the point where ECB has cut 200 basis points. The German 30-year yields at 14-year highs. The Japanese 10-year yield at the highest level since 2007. The UK 30-year gilt yield is just off its highest level since the 1990s. And even the US 30-year sticking around 480 here. It's actually up a few basis points since right before the Fed cut.
Will there be yield curve control by the Fed?
So, you know, I'm having conversations more with people about that, and people are throwing it out there. But I think yield curve control is the emergency lever behind the glass, where it specifically says on the glass, pull in an emergency only. Yield curve control when the 10-year yield is at 415, I mean, it's people are getting a little ahead of themselves thinking that this is what they're going to do. Now, okay, so this then, I'll segue into the $40 billion of supposed QE, not QE, whatever you want to call it. It's clear that with the regulatory structure we have in the banking system, that every time the Fed wants to exit stage left in terms of its footprints on the markets pull them back in. And the markets did it again ahead of year-end potential funding pressures and what will likely be big tax payments going into April of next year that will drain reserves from the banking system as the government pays it out. And the Fed wanted to get ahead of it by this announcement. Now, I know everyone wants to get excited thinking it's QE, and every time that the Fed increases the size of their balance sheet, they call it QE. But keep in mind, The Fed's balance sheet for decades rose basically in line with the demand for money and the size of the economy. So if you do the math, and I recommend people to do the math, what the Fed announced is really only increasing their balance sheet in line with where nominal GDP will grow into April of next year. So that's why I know people have gotten excited about it, but you got to put it into the context. Now, if they start growing their balance sheet well above the size of the economy, well, that's QE. And if they start buying longer term treasuries, that would be QE. But this is more in line with the economy. So, that's why long end rates didn't really do anything, even though they're obviously just buying T-bills. And the 2-year yield did fall in response to that. But I think people should just put it into context mm-hmm. with the need for this in this current regulatory world we're in terms of the demand for reserves, and also relative to the size of nominal GDP, where their balance sheet is not growing.
That's a good point. Yeah, exactly. You got thoughts, Ira, on that?
Yeah. Very good point. And, to settle down and take things in its full perspective, I think is the right way to put it. But more importantly, let's go to that press conference. And again, I'm not in any way, shape, going to embarrass Peter, but I was embarrassed for everybody who calls themselves the media. There was maybe one or two good questions. It was so obsequious. Not one question. And I won my bet because I said, there should be a question on gold, not a question on gold. Does it not concern the Fed chair and the whole FOMC that gold prices? So explain it away in a very open platform like that would have been very worthwhile. And then again, with all the nonsense and all the nonsense questions, the Washington Post question was so ridiculous. Not that it wasn't needed to be asked, but there's no way. Why waste a question unless you're just mentally masturbating yourself? Because there's no way Powell would have offered any answer on the coming Supreme Court decision. So that was ridiculous. But they're so obsequious. Why not talk about fiscal dominance? Because that's what we're in here. We're in fiscal dominance. And I don't have to be a genius to figure it out. The long end of the curve tells me. And if it wasn't so, they would be issuing more coupons on the long end, and we wouldn't be hearing so much about stable coins with T-bills, and because they wouldn't worry about it. But they're worried about it. And the cost of funding this deficit rises. When will it bite? Just like we talked with Grohman last week. I don't know. And Peter doesn't know, or anybody else who does substantive fundamental analysis of where we're at. We don't know. And you could see yesterday, and the press conference was so bad that Powell wanted to be hawkish. And he couldn't, because for the first 5 minutes of his speech, and maybe the first question, when it said, well, when they asked whether this was the end, right? That was Howard Schneider, and then Leisman followed that up with, and Nick Timiraos returning to the 1990s. These are ridiculous questions as to where we're at. Why not about fiscal dominance? Because is the Fed not more fearful of the increasing interest costs on the deficit? And it's enormous and growing. So where is this, and how does this force the Fed to act? And look at, it's amazing. When you have 2,500 economists or whatever the number is on your payroll, you can pick and choose whatever you want. But it was Charles Calamaris, who was writing for the St. Louis Fed, who wrote about fiscal dominance. And it's not a very difficult paper to read. And why nobody comes prepared for that is beyond me. And it really doesn't do a service for those who are really in the financial business, because it's important to understand this. As Peter and I are talking, and Peter talked about, commodities and where are we at and how is this going to be? So how do they think they're going to get inflation under control? Now, whatever that means, but the Fed gets to define it, right? The Fed, it's a wonderful thing as an economist. It fulfills what Harry Truman said in 1949 or 1950, all he wanted was a one-arm economist, because it's always on the other hand, on the other hand. And that's what the dual mandate provides for the theoretical and model building economists, is that you can always, there's always a fallback. So yesterday, the media walked right into it for Powell. And why did they cut? Because of the labor numbers, right? And he said that we believe, meaning the FOMC believes, that the labor numbers are stated, what was the number? I think 40,000 too high.
So yeah, so he said that, and this is according to their staff, even though the ADP private sector number all year doesn't confirm this, but that the 40,000 plus average job gains this year through September, because that's all the data they have, was overstated by 60,000. Therefore, we're averaging minus 20. There was no color around that. I don't know where he got it from. He got it from staff, but no doubt that the labor market has slowed this year. But I think to say that it was minus 20 is a reach, at least for this year.
Yeah. And so again, and when they did ask, like Claire Jones from the FT asked some really good questions, and Powell fell back on the Phillips curve. I mean, I kept watching it, and the movement of the markets, because first they wanted to say, oh, there's no more cuts. So of course, the equity market started breaking, the metals market started breaking. And then when that was reversed, everybody realized, especially again, because we don't really understand that 40 billion yet with the T-bills, right? We're still trying to wrap our heads around this and the way it's going to work. And then he threw out, well, we're going to have to do this because, and I didn't hear that at first, but then when I went, because somebody brought it up to me and I went back and listened to it, yeah, he brought up the tax date of April 15th, that they're already worried about being short. So, you know, I, as a global investor, you know, if it was Powell who put in these regular press conferences, because Bernanke and Yellen both use quarter and Greenspan use none. And one of the more interesting discussions that took place, which I don't know why it was, Tim Rose brought it up, comparing the present day to the 1990s, right? Now, for the life of me, why? Because you got three cuts and then a raise. That's, so they did that homework, but that was like a preposterous thing to bring up, because there's, we are so in different places, and to just, you're just looking at raw numbers. But interestingly, Jerome Powell, what did he bring? He actually answered it in when Axios brought it up further, and he actually reached into the possibility, and it went back to the 90s again, that the Axios asked, is this a positive productivity shock? Now, that's something I have not, oh, that's going back to the 90s. And he really, if he had any intellectual integrity, he just would have called it what Greenspan called it, a conundrum. Gee, you know, I don't know. But he didn't, and he just said, yeah, we have a productivity shock. I find that hard to believe. I'm not there yet. Is it possible with AI? Yes, of course it's possible, because that's what technology is all about. But again, I'm trying to understand this and put this together on a global macro sense. And the Fed really did not do themselves a service yesterday, because again, everything, when everything started to turn in reverse and Powell had wanted to prevent a hawkish face, he failed in that miserably. So I just bring that up for, because it's necessary to understand. And again, the bond market, look at the bonds really did nothing today. They did nothing at the, we're closing in, you know, the after. So we're basically unchanged on the day on the 30 year, nothing. So it's again, and that's the only pertinent question, is that they keep cutting. And as Peter writes about regularly and talked about it, all that bond yields have done around the globe this year have gone higher with everybody cutting, Europe. And yet, so that tells you that you have a great problem facing you. And I think we have to be very attentive to that. This morning, we heard from the Swiss National Bank, and I bring it up because I think the Swiss National Bank is a important weather vane of what's going on in the world. And they're at 0% on overnight rates. And they have another problem because the currency is way too strong for their overall economy on a relative basis. When we talk about currency strength or weakness, it's always on a relative basis. But the Swiss is strong around the globe, and they know it. And inflation numbers are weak. Their unemployment numbers are holding, but at, for them, elevated levels. And the SNB, the Swiss National Bank, actually in their statement this morning said they're going to be active in the foreign exchange market, right? Because they don't want the currency that high. So what happened today? Yeah, the Swiss went up. The Swiss went up 1% against the dollar, basically. So nothing, and that to me is a weather vane because the Swiss are the poster child of fiscal responsibility. And therefore, even at zero interest rates, their currency is desired for that reason. And I think that's a very important thing as we go forward.
Yeah, and the dollar index, which is obviously yen and euro heavy, but includes the Swiss, closed at a 2-month low today.
Yeah, and everybody is so bulled up. Everybody I talked to is bulled up on the dollar. For a lot
Yeah,
of
I think the
reasons.
dollar's toast next year.
Well, I'm getting, yes, and you know what? So, Peter, so that's where we're at. And your points continually, every day in your work, when you bring up where the global bond markets are, because that's the danger. It's just not the U.S. This is a global phenomenon. The Japanese are in it. Look at it. We've seen the JGBs, the Japanese 10-year. Rise, what, 80 or 90 basis points in yields this year as the bank has done nothing. And and you've talked about it, and I've talked about it. We've talked about it on podcasts, talked about it going back to Mark Faber in May, that if they weren't going to do anything, the market was going to do it for them, and JGB yields were going to rise dramatically. And that's exactly what they've done. But they're not the only one. They're all across the board, so much so that even, again, French yields under 10-year, under French haute, are 2 or 3 basis points higher than, of all things, the Italian yields. So you're in this situation, but the bonds, so let's go back to the question that Peter entertained. Are we going to see yield curve control? Well, it's a good question. How far will, again, as I stated with Grohman, and I've talked with you about it, Peter, I really thought that Bessent was going to be able to, and hope for a failed auction in order to cause a crisis that would make everybody sit up and think. But he panicked. Not that he panicked, but he turned away from that. And he's pushing more T-bills out the door than Yellen and Brainard ever did. So he saw something that scared him. But I'm with you. The bond markets are really something to pay attention to. And with that, the Swiss National Bank, because the fact that they're at zero and this currency is really in a strength mode tells you that the world is very focused on sovereign debt.
Agreed. I mean, there is, I guess, a form of yield curve control. I mean, Yellen tried to control the yields by issuing less longer dated paper that Bessent criticized and is now doing the same thing. So, in a soft way, they're trying to cap any rise in long term rates. But a strict official yield curve control. I know everyone looks to Japan and sees what they did over many decades, but that's sort of blowing up in their face right now. And you know who it blew up in their face not too long ago? The Reserve Bank of Australia, which after 2020, during COVID, they experimented and it was a disaster. And they got rid of it rather quickly. And the day that they did, yields spiked right in their face. So I don't think there's a good experience. It's a roach motel. It's so nice to say, oh yeah, let's just do it. But doing it is easy. Getting out of it is extraordinarily difficult and much easier said than done.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And you bring up that point about the Japanese. I'm going to tell you, I was on with Rick Santelli on the day that they announced yield curve control. And Rick, he had brought me, he says, let's talk about that. I said, yes. I said, I would do it 2 years and less, but why would you go out that farther? Especially, you don't need to let the markets tell you whether you're successful or not. You know, there's so, again, that's the problem with the academic modelers and all the people who work. They're so afraid of the markets to be used as signaling mechanisms to tell them when their policies are actually working. That's why, you know, we saw it yesterday, because as soon as the market began to understand what they were going to do with the reserves and the $40 billion a month, you know, for X amount of time, they said, well, we don't need, and if they're, you know, if they don't raise, because Powell was certainly adamant that they're not necessarily raising, whether there's more cuts, we'll see. But that liquidity. So again, liquidity add. And it's a global phenomenon. You know, it's just not the U.S., but the U.S. sits in a very different place because of its role as a reserve currency. That gives you a responsibility that the others don't have. Do I care about whether Australia fails with that or not? Not really. I mean, I do as an investor trader. Do I care? Europe is going to be very interesting. Japan is a different animal. And I really get a little peeved when people compare it so readily. First of all, because the Japanese have huge amounts of savings all over the world. And I'm not talking about the value of Yellowstone Park or the Grand Tetons and be able to mortgage that, right? I'm talking about serious, easy to get your hands on foreign direct, savings all over the world. So much so that if there was a catastrophe in Japan, a financial catastrophe, that they, as we've seen over many decades, that brings money home. And that bring that money, and Yellen and Brainard both knew it, as did Christine Lagarde when they were prodding Kuroda not to raise rates because they were worried about a bond earthquake. I'm sorry to use that metaphor with Japan. That's not good. Let me use something else. But it's certainly a bond upheaval. And it would be global nature. So they kept pushing Kuroda, don't raise rates. And that's why they were willing to tolerate a weaker yen. But we'll get to that because the weak yen is causing other types of problems. Again, in global finance, like most other things in physics, there's, as Milton Friedman wonderfully said, there's no free lunch. It's going to make its, the pain is going to make its way elsewhere. Just like Doomberg's great piece today about why the sanctioning of the Russians' shadow fleet hasn't worked and will not work. There are just too many other ramifications. The same thing when Trump was bullying China and China said, okay, no more rare earths for you. Now all of a sudden everybody said, whoa, we got vulnerabilities too. So there's always something else that you have to look out for.
One last point on yield curve control. The other thing that it does is it handcuffs a central bank, because just imagine if the Fed implemented this with Treasury, the dollar, instead of being 98, would probably be 78. The price of gold, instead of being 4,200, would probably be 6,200 to 7,200. The price of silver would be 100. Copper would go through the roof. We would immediately have an inflation problem just on the announcement of yield curve control, which then what's the Fed going to do? So that's why people just throw it out there like it's some easy thing, but it's really not. But that said, again, Bessent is doing his own sort of soft control. as Yellen did. But I think an official one that is, that's when the tenure gets the 6%, when they would even consider something like that.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. And just coming back to Japan, Peter, what are your thoughts and forecast on the Japanese yen? Do you see a potential unwinding of that carry trade with repatriation of assets back to Japan?
Well, there's no doubt the yen is cheap and extraordinarily cheap, but it's been cheap for a period of time and always difficult to know when it's not going to be cheap anymore. Yes, I do think that there's that repatriation risk, especially as yields continue to rise there and the BOJ raising interest rates. So that is a daily risk. But I think the value of the yen where it is doesn't necessarily believe it's going to happen. You know, I think the one interesting thing with the dollar this year, and something that I talked about coming into the year, is that, and I'll tie this into the Mag 7 trade. You know, the Mag 7 trade not just became, you know, a dominant holding for U.S. investors, it became a dominant holding for global investors. And it became almost its own reserve asset. And you can chart over the last couple of years as the Mag 7 stocks rallied, the dollar rallied, and vice versa. But then after Liberation Day, when, you know, we started a trade war with the rest of the world, they both fell together. But then when we rebounded a week later, when they pulled back the tariffs to an extent or paused them, tech stocks bounced back, but the dollar did not. And things that I've read and things that I've seen, foreigners kept buying U.S. stocks, but they were hedging their dollar exposure to a great extent. So that's why there all of a sudden became a disconnect between the rallying and the tech stocks and the dollar that couldn't get out of its own way. Because foreign investors said, yeah, you know, we'll still invest in U.S. assets, but we don't like where this trade war is going. We need to be careful about how the U.S. dollar is going to be treated. And we need to start increasing our hedging. And I think that continues. And particularly with the Fed continuously now cutting interest rates, that hedging is going to continue on. Because if it doesn't, well, then foreigners are going to, instead of saying, hey, we're not going to bother hedging, we're just going to own less U.S. assets, which is a possibility too. Because, I mean, look, what are the best performing assets this year? It's not in the U.S., it's overseas. When I tell people that the Spanish stock market is up, and let me just see it right now, in dollar terms, is up 65% year to date. The Italian MIB is up 45% in dollar terms. The S&P 500 up 17%. That's nothing compared to the returns that we've seen in international markets, helped in part due to that weaker dollar, which if it continues, and I think it does, the big market trends that occurred in 2025, where investors found a whole world of things to buy, I do think that continues into 2026, including commodities, and maybe oil finally gets a bid.
What about other emerging markets like Latin America, Southeast Asia?
I think that Southeast Asian currencies are very cheap. I think that the same can be said for Latin America. And I think that, again, the 2025 pattern of a weaker dollar, rising international markets, not just in stocks, but also bonds, and rising commodity prices, I think will continue on into 2026. Now, I'm talking my book. I'm long a bunch of commodity stocks and non-dollar assets. So I want it to happen as I'm positioned, but I believe in it as well with my our money, the firm's money, where our mouths are.
Your thoughts, Ira, on these?
Okay, yeah. This is great. So we have not discussed this for an iota, but interestingly, and I know Judd is going to love this because we've looked at this chart for so many years, but very few people pay attention to it. But there was an article in the FT and other places talking on Monday, I believe, and people were talking about it, that the yuan needs to appreciate, that the Chinese, and they use this word, that the Chinese were manipulating the currency, keeping it too low, which is why the trade balance doesn't correct. And I'm going to give you I think that's, we can historically talk about, but then I go back to January 1st, 1994, when the Chinese officially devalued the yuan. January 1st, they devalued the renminbi, whatever you want to call it, the renminbi or the yuan. They devalued it from 5.8 to 8.7. That's a 50% devaluation. And it was also the same day that NAFTA started. That's historical fact. Now, I don't think there's 435 people in Congress. If I ask that question to 436 of them, none of them would have the right answer because they really don't pay attention to it. So that's a very important date. But more importantly, if you look at they're talking about that the yuan is undervalued. But if you look at the yuan yen, that date becomes important. Because the yuan is the strongest it's been against the yen basically in 33 years. That's significant. You can beat up on the Chinese all you want, but why do the Japanese sit there and get a free pass? We're at a 33-year high of the Chinese currency against the yen. Sorry, that to me is a very important part as well as the Chinese story. And in fact, what's his name, Brad Setzer from the Council on Foreign Relations and Mark Sobel from the from OMFIF, they were pushing at Georgieva, who's the IMF director, to push the Chinese to appreciate their currency, the renminbi. But wait a minute, where are you going there? And then in the same breath, the Europeans came out and accused the Chinese of keeping the renminbi too low to gain a trade advantage. And the Europeans and the Chinese are really at odds right now. They're trying to make nice as the Germans and von der Leyen, who's the president of the EU, and Macron, they were just in China. So they're trying to find their way without being, as Macron talked about 2 years ago, a vassal state to the United States, and they want to find their own way here. But the weak yen is killing them. It's killing them. You cannot complain about and the German auto sector is really in trouble. And I'm bullish on Germany, not the auto sector, but with the yen as weak as it is, it's very difficult for the European automakers to overcome China and Japan. So before people start pointing their damn finger at the Chinese, I would do a little homework and understand where you are, because currencies are always relative. They're all relative, whether it's to the dollar or to other things. And that makes a huge difference. And I'll go back to the Swiss bank statement today. The Swiss remains willing to be active in the foreign exchange market as necessary. Well, the Swiss compete, as I talked about with Luke Roman, the Swiss compete head on with the Japanese in pharmaceuticals, in high-end optics, in high-end machinery. The Japanese are in a position to kick a lot of proverbial butt all over. Yeah. But I would make almost the same case with Canada because of Trudeau's crappy policies, and thank God that ended, and Cynthia Freeland also gone, because they did so much damage. I'm not necessarily a great Carney fan, but Carney sees it. And interestingly, things are so cheap again because the Canadian dollar is on a relative cheap basis, that Europe and Canada made a deal this week with letting Canada into their defense appropriation. So the Canadian defense industries are going to be producing for the European defense buildup. So these are, which is why you're starting to see people wake up to the Canada, because, you know, between energy and rare earths and other, Again, as I say, Canada is a land in search of a people because there's so much open space and so much, and they're so rich in energy and raw materials. But these things are taking place, and wake up to the currencies. Don't just push at the Chinese. The Chinese have their issues. But if you look at the renminbi yuan, because I always watch dollar yuan, yeah, it's meandering here. But if you look at it on a relative basis, especially against the Japanese, sorry, you're not going to, and the IMF as usual, the last time the IMF was right was probably 1944 when it was formed in Bretton Woods. but outside of that, its history is very suspect.
Peter, energy, you've been bullish on this, especially recently. Can you elaborate a bit more on that? Is that in the oil and gas sector only, or and is it under producers or servicing companies?
Well, I've been saying and making the argument that a barrel of oil at about $60 is one of the cheapest assets in the world. And I can't tell you when it's going to go up, but when I find something I believe is cheap, to me, it's just a timing issue. And when I define cheap, you're talking about anything really below here seriously disrupts the profitability of U.S. shale. U.S. shale is the biggest, or I should say U.S. oil production in totality is the largest global oil producer with now 13, I think, 0.8 million barrels a day. And I think one of the challenges and on the supply side is if you look at all the basins within the U.S., ex-Permian, it's rolling over in terms of the production. And even the Permian in October saw a year-over-year decline in oil production. So when I look at that, I said, okay, that's worth paying attention to. Maybe, you know, technology will find more oil and crack that rock even harder and get more stuff out. But at least right now, the pace of incremental oil production out of U.S. shale is slowing down. And U.S. shale has been the biggest, most dominant producer of non-OPEC plus supply, call it over the last 15, 20 years when shale really came to creation. Then I look at OPEC, which is already brought back probably about 2.5 million barrels in quotas that they took off during COVID. And oil has sort of stopped going down around these $60 level, which tells me that the market's already absorbed that impact, and also seeing statistics that OPEC production is not necessarily meeting up with quotas, and the quotas are more meeting where production already was. And also spare capacity is really down to just the UAE and Saudi right now, with very limited spare capacity in other places. I know there's a big debate on the demand side. Is it 800 million barrels a day? I'm sorry, 800 1,000 barrels a day? Is it 1 million barrels a day of growth? Or is it, you know, 1.2, 1.3? Regardless, call it 1 million, which is still decent. And, you know, and I know China, everyone's looking at, okay, well, they're driving hybrids and EVs. Well, hybrids still use oil, but, you know, EVs too. But they've been stockpiling oil in their own version of their strategic petroleum reserve. And I've seen estimates that that's been 800, 900 thousand barrels a day. So I think all in all, there's not much downside in oil because, like I said, you probably shut down a lot of shale if you get another leg down. I wouldn't be surprised if the Saudis said, okay, time out on these quota increases, because Saudi still needs the money from producing oil. In fact, they need probably $85 oil just to balance their budget, and they've created for themselves massive amounts of financial obligations over the next 5 to 10 years. So there is a price pain point also for Saudi. And I think once these sort of production increases and quotas are sort of more in line with how they want them, I think that'll be it. So you're in a sense creating what I believe is a floor under the price of oil, with definite potential for upside if U.S. oil production slows further, or if Saudi just says, you know what, you know, we need oil at 70 instead of 60 because we need more money to finance all the things we're doing. So I think that's a possibility too. And if the Fed gets further with their rate cuts, if the dollar takes another leg down, we're seeing a bunch of rallies in obviously other commodities. We see gold and silver on a daily basis, but the CRB Raw Industrials Index closed at the highest level in multiple years. So keep your eye on that. And, you know, copper's been spiking. But the interesting thing about the CRB Raw Industrials is there are commodities in there that don't trade on futures. So it's really a spot index for a bunch of different commodities in industrial metals and textiles and so on. So oil is lagged. And I think that, you know, oil is due for a lot of catch up. And when I talk about one of the cheapest assets in the world, relative to the price of gold, and for many years, and Ira probably did this back in the day, you know, there was a gold to oil ratio that people paid attention to, sort of a relative value basis. And you look at that ratio now, and I don't know if oil's been ever cheaper relative to mm-hmm. the price of gold.
Yep. What do you think, Ira?
Well, it was when we went negative for that, you know, in April, when was it, of 2021, Peter?
Yeah. But if you look at Brent that day, didn't have that same delivery issue. Brent got down to like $19, and but you know that was one day. So, I say, you know what? I say we bottomed at 19 rather than going negative. Mm. But yes,
and you know what? I love. So we're on this discussion, and the greatest part about it, because I read what you say, and you, and I'm, of course, energy is, you know, such a mainstay if you're involved in this business of being in global macro. Energy is very important, but I love the battle, the quiet battle, because it's not obnoxious, between, you know, Goering and Rosenzweig and Doomberg. Because when people who I respect have differences of opinion with each other, I learn a hell of a lot more. And I'm learning a lot because it forces me to go read to see why the differences exist and where I might be willing to learn a little bit. And I'm lucky to live where I could talk to people, because I'll share this with them, who, you know, one guy, I'll call him Al, was a lifetime petroleum engineer for Schlumberger. So, you know, I can sit and talk to him about this, as I know another one, Mike, who's actually a Kansas Wildcatter. So, you know, I get very differences of opinion.
They can both be right, I think, Ira. I think Adam and Lee can be right over the next, call it, 2 years.
Yeah.
And Doomberg is right big picture, because, yes, they're technology is an incredible thing, and we always find a way to find more oil. And you have fields of Guyana, for example, and the possibility of Venezuela, even though that'll probably take 5 years before that comes to fruition, whatever. But yeah, I think he can be right too, in terms of there's still a lot of supply out there in the world, but there are moments in time when there are supply demand disruptions, and you don't need that much of a difference between, call it, 105 million barrels a day of demand and 105 million barrels a day of supply, and they get off kilter. And right now people argue we have a little more supply than demand, and maybe that can, you know, you can have a run in oil that then encourages that other supply that Doomberg talks about that can come onto the market. So, it's a cyclical business like anything else. And Doomberg can be right about oil, but that doesn't mean it's not going to have a spike to $120. It may go back down to 60, but it can go up first before it goes back down again.
Yeah. Right. I agree totally. And nothing says more than what Carney in Canada has said, that he's going to take Canada, turn it back into an energy powerhouse, because Trudeau did a lot of damage in his zero carbon, because he believes, you know, well, if we're not going to produce it, nobody's going to use it. Well, that's about as naive, you know, that, because somebody's going to burn it. And it was a huge mistake. So you see already Canada's, you know, he's got the proposal. And Alberta's, you know, very excited, because they're going to build that pipeline to through British Columbia to the Pacific, that will satisfy, or not satisfy, but help satisfy Asian markets, right? Because it's kind of tough to go from Canada, you know, and then you have to go down through the Gulf, you know, to the Mexico, which they blocked the Keystone Pipeline, right? So They spent a lot of time blocking, and the United States, of course, had a role in blocking that too. But I agree with you. I think, overall, and it's in the best interest. Right now, I think some are trying to placate Trump, especially out of the Middle East, so they may be pumping a little bit more. And as Doomberg, tongue in cheek, said in his piece today, which was really quite good, he said the United States should be pushing, they shouldn't be sanctioning Russian oil. He said that the U.S. Navy should be running interference for all the Russian ships to bring all the oil out that they want.
Right, to crash the price of oil, which would then bankrupt Russia. Look at it from that perspective, of course.
I never understood why they cut Russia off, because now you have all those funds that Russia had to pay out to all those foreign investors who are now basically in Russian hands. So you're not doing, why'd you stop that? The more money that would have been flown out would have been less for the war effort. I see the world in a totally different way, but again.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see. Final thoughts, Peter, like on the precious metals market, gold, silver, platinum.
Yeah, still bullish on that. I actually want to make my last point, because I think a big story of 2026 is certainly going to be what develops of this AI tech trade and the data center build out, and what impact it has on the economy and the markets. Because the interesting thing about technology is when there's this new great thing, every investor wants to invest in any company touching it in any which way. And we saw that since early 2023, when we all got wind of OpenAI and ChatGPT and Microsoft's involvement, and then it just snowballed from there. But I think a couple of things have happened over the last 3 months. One started with the stock market reaction in Oracle, not necessarily on the day we're taping this when it fell sharply, but how it rolled over when people realized that 60% of their performance obligations was with OpenAI. And then you also had Gemini 3 coming out with a better model than OpenAI, even though that'll probably flip back and forth. But people started to realize, you know what? Not everyone's going to win. Not everyone is going to get a trophy here, and there are going to be winners and losers. And that, I think, is going to be a big deal in 2026 as the market more differentiates this entire investment. And we also have to watch, at what point do we reach where we say, okay, I think we built one too many data centers too many. The size of these data centers we talked about earlier, 4 million square feet, I Googled that, and Gemini told me it's the size of 60 football fields. There's just an extraordinary amount of build-out that's going on. And I look at my phone, and I think that, the history of technology is that hardware gets smaller, the software and the computing power gets stronger. So how does anyone know how many square feet of data centers we're going to need in 3 years? Maybe we need 2 million instead of 4 million in that particular facility, and it'll have even stronger computing power, but half the space is needed. And so I don't know how anybody's smart enough to know what is enough. And also, finally, on this point, that these stocks are highly capital intensive businesses, and their business models are still exciting, but definitely different in terms of the revenue generating capabilities and the returns on equity and the debt that they're taking on to build this out. And because it's still a dominant part of the stock market, I think how this unfolds is going to be hugely important. And if the sort of build out of these models starts to slow in terms of its rate of improvements, well, then you also risk that conversation. Well, we really don't need that extra data center because we're really not getting enough incremental build out. Let's start canceling chip orders. Those are the things I think people really need to think about as we go into next year.
If I can add, see, because what Peter says is just so right on, because this is capitalism. This is, I don't care whether you go back to the railroads, I don't care if you go back to the automobile. There were hundreds of automobile manufacturers. There were very few that survived, or they consolidated. Railroads, they laid, everybody, It's and then with overseas shipping, you know, until we saw the East India Company actually form into a, or the British, the Dutch East India can form into a, an actual stockholding endeavor. But this has been going on forever. So people rush in. That's what they're supposed to do. With I got a better idea. Well, you might, but can you sustain it? And with enough, do you have enough capital? And that's, you know, when the market was shaking a little bit today, again, we were back to Oracle and the messages they sent about, you know, the financing. So, but that's, and now you're on top of with all the government financing. So I think your points are really well taken. Can I predict it? No. Can you predict it? If you could, I got other things I want to talk to you about, but it'll work itself through, and that's the way capitalism works. There's winners and there's losers. There's no
and
question.
And we know too that technology changes fast, and if you're going to spend all this money with things that change so fast, it definitely complicates how this is all going to turn out.
Oh, absolutely. And again, there's a lot of people with some very deep pockets also searching for the holy grail of AI.
Right.
And to do it with a lot less energy, because the energy becomes, you know, we didn't even get into that, but and we'll stop here, but that becomes a political issue, because as everybody's electric, you know, you may all be using AI. We're benefiting from it as a quote unquote, a common good, but there's a lot of people making a lot of money, but all I know is my electricity bills are going higher, or my energy bills are going monstrously higher. And I'm not seeing, it aids me in this and this, but no different than, you know, in the 50s, the television did, or so, you know, it's just at a far greater speed and able to do more. But that's going to be a very serious issue, because the politics of it, because it's going to leave people with some very staggering energy costs.
Yeah, I think that's the limiting factor, will be the limiting factor, is the cost of energy, you know, limiting that development. You could have a situation where cost of a human becomes less than the cost of robot, AI robot. But yeah, Peter has a good point on the software. Basically, software can emulate hardware, and the Chinese have taken that more software, lower cost approach with Manus and DeepSeek, those type of. So eventually, you have the usage of the data centers, but maybe later, if you go more of the lower cost software approach.
Right, exactly, and that's why these buildings, you know, I kid around and I say there'll be potentially a lot of space for pickleball courts.
Okay, great. It's been a fascinating, insightful discussion. How can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work, Peter?
On the wealth management side, they can learn more about our firm at onepointbfg.com and my daily writings, the book report on Substack. And I write every day on the macro economic and markets, and also do a lot of micro work as well, especially during earnings season.
Nice. Great. And Ira?
I'm just, I do these podcasts and I still enjoy them, and we get to share, listen, to sit with Peter and actually discuss for an hour is just a delight. I mean, I can email with him and he's very gracious in answering. But this is great, and hope we ferret out. You know, again, we're not touting things. We never tout things. We try to put you in a direction where you'll be able to make some profitable trades. Because again, if you can't turn these and make them actionable, all this discussion, then we kind of really have not done much. You know, we may as well go sit with on the View and talk with them. But this is, you know, I think a lot of really good ideas get generated now. They have been in the past, which is why we keep doing it, I think, because it's really good to share like this.
Yep. Great. Great. And Judd, if you want to put up your webpage and contact information. Yep. Okay, great. Thanks very much, Peter, Ira, and Judd. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Okay. Thank you. Great.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.